Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Would you like a DTNS hat, hoodie, mask, or mouse pad? We got them all. The DTNS store, dailytechnewsshow.com/store. Coming up on DTNS, Intel's impressive Alder Lake chips are finally real. Some context to bring to your reading of the Facebook papers. And Scott Johnson breaks down all the news from Adobe Max. This is the Daily Tech News for Wednesday, October 27th, 2021 in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
In Salt Lake City, I'm Scott Johnson.
And I'm Roger Chang, the show's producer.
We're talking about noodles, all the noodles that Scott sent to Sarah Lane to eat. If you want to hear about those noodles, get Good Day Internet. Also talk a little bit about my new M1 Max MacBook. That's at patreon.com/DTNS, where you can join our top patrons like Dustin Campbell, Tim Deputy, and Brandon Brooks. Big thanks to all of you. Let's start with a few tech things you should know. Microsoft announced plans to expand the number of data centers it operates around the world while reducing the amount of water it uses to cool its data centers by 95% by 2024. Microsoft has pledged to replenish more water than it uses by the end of the decade. So halfway through the decade, this will get them pretty close. The Verge notes that a typical data center uses as much water as a city of at least 30,000 people per day. To reduce water cooling, Microsoft plans to set higher temperature limits based on some intense research it did about how warm a data center could actually get and still run well. That alone, they think, might get them where they want to be in the cooler climates, you know, like the Netherlands. But in warmer, drier regions, Microsoft will also plan to implement a closed-loop immersion system that uses fluorocarbon-based liquid baths. You know, you may say, like, my refrigerator used to do that. This is a little different at the scale of a data center. That system is still in research and development right now, and the team ran its first tests on it in April.
30,000 people worth of water. Wow.
That's one effing
hit. That's a lot. Every product release, and particularly high-profile releases like those from Apple, they usually come with some sort of defect meme, right? Whether it's antenna gate or what have
yellowing.
You. Sure, all these things are always come up. Well, the new MacBook Pros have a notch scandal. Social networks abound with shocked and outraged videos of menu bar items disappearing and becoming inaccessible behind the laptop's notch.
Nah.
Oh no, what are we to do? Meanwhile, iFixit stumbled upon some happy news in its teardown of the M1-based MacBook Pros. The battery has pull tabs. And that might mean what you think it means. A couple of the battery cells are under the trackpad assembly, but the others are not, and none of them are glued or screwed in there. Looks like the battery in the new MacBook Pro is indeed replaceable.
So your menu items are temporarily inaccessible. You can replace the battery, folks. Stop your whining. While Facebook made billions last quarter, it did note reduced advertising revenue attributed to the change in how Apple allows third-party tracking, which means you have to get someone to agree to it, and you can't just slip it in there anymore. Same was true for Snap. They noted the same effect. Twitter, on the other hand, was fine. In fact, Twitter reported a 37% jump in Q3 revenue overall, and ad sales rose 41% year over year. Twitter CFO Ned Legal noted that the ad ecosystem is still adjusting to Apple's change, but said this has been less of a factor for us. Twitter also wasn't impacted by supply chain issues, which depressed some other advertising as well. So Twitter relies largely on brand ads, not targeted ads, for digital goods and services, which are not affected by supply chain. So Twitter's golden. However, Twitter did report a net loss in the quarter based on a $766 million cost of settling a class action lawsuit from 2016. That lawsuit alleged that Twitter misled advertisers. They settled that. So if you see that they lost a lot of money, that's why. Otherwise, they did well.
I think of a guy named Legal works in your accounting department. I hope there's a guy named Money who works in the legal department. Anyway, moving on. DJI announced the Action 2 camera.
Not Legal. That was me saying it wrong.
DJI announced the Action 2 camera, dropping the Oslo name and adding a magnetic system for accessories. The 53-gram Action 2 module has a 12-megapixel sensor for 4K recording. So that's pretty good. A 155-degree field of view and a 1.7-inch Gorilla Glass OLED touchscreen. It comes with 32 megabytes of storage as well. Available accessories include additional touchscreens and batteries and mounts. The Action 2 bundled with a second screen is coming November 2nd for $519. And a bundle with just an extra power module is coming mid-November, that one for $399.
My apologies to Ned Siegel. The U.S. Copyright Office published its once every 3 years list of exemptions to the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act. These are a list of things that you can legally circumvent copyright protection in order to do. Most of the items that were already on the list were renewed. That includes things like ripping a DVD for educational use, unlocking a cell phone. But the office also replaced a list of items you were allowed to circumvent copyright protection to repair. They had a list of these are the items you can do that with. And now they just have a broader definition that applies to any consumer device that relies on software to function. So if it's a consumer device, you're pretty much in the clear to fix the software anyway, as well as non-consumer devices, things like medical devices, sea and land vehicles. There's a list of those. So not every non-consumer device, but there's a broader list of those. Basically, if it uses software, you can circumvent copyright protection to diagnose, maintain, and repair your device. Now, there are some limitations. Video game consoles, for instance, only allow you to repair the optical drive. And any circumvention that you do after you're done repairing the optical drive has to be put back in place. So you can't repair the optical drive and then rip all your games. The office also expanded exemptions for making video accessible, preserving disc-based media, allowing people who can't see to circumvent ebook copyright protection so they can do text-to-speech, stuff like that. All right.
Slow and steady wins the race for these changes. That's how they do it. Slow and steady.
And Library of Congress has been pretty good at listening to appeals from places like the EFF, in other words. Let's talk about those new chips. Intel announced its line of 12th gen Alder Lake chips. The top level processor is the i9-12900K. In fact, Intel calls that the world's best gaming processor. These are the chips that Intel promised at CES in January. Gave us details about in July at Architecture Day, and today you can buy them. We aren't going to run through every single model, but here's the overview. The Core i9 top level, the 12900K, offers 16 cores split evenly between the P cores, the performance cores, and the E cores, the efficiency cores, 24 threads, clock speeds of 5.2 gigahertz, and Intel promises a 19% performance improvement over the 11th gen. There's a Core i7 version that has 12 cores and 20 threads. Core i5 has 10 cores and 16 threads. You can get all three of those with or without integrated graphics. It's a KF in the model number if it doesn't have the GPU on there. All three of these give you up to 20 PCIe lanes, support for DDR5 memory, and larger L3 and L2 caches. So, fast and future-proof for the most part. But you'll need a new 600 series motherboard, preferably the Z690 chipset if you want flexible overclocking. That adds Wi-Fi 6E and the faster USB 3.2 data transfer, but it also may require you to add a new cooler. They all run a base of 125 watts, but can spike higher, with the i9 hitting 241 watts. Intel promises other big improvements if you run Windows 11, thanks to the co-development of Thread Director that intelligently assigns tasks to the right core, the P or the E core. Another notable thing is Alder Lake chips are built on Intel's 10 nanometer process. I think I've been talking about this since Buzz Out Loud, but they finally did it. 10 nanometer process, not the previous 14 nanometer process. And if you recall, this is the process that Intel calls Intel 7, because nanometers ain't nothing but a number to Intel. So if it's 10, they're just going to call it 7. They want you to believe their design is just as good as another company's 7-nanometer process, and it might be. The benchmarks will tell, but it is pretty impressive. There's more to come with Alder Lake's mobile versions are coming in 2022. We'll probably get details about those at CES. Top-of-the-line i9-12900K costs you $589 with integrated graphics, or $564 without. And the cheapest i5-12600 without graphics is $264. Pre-order start today, shipping November 4th. Roger, I know you followed this stuff really closely. How do you feel about this? Everybody seems to think this is a positive Intel announcement. Do you agree?
This is the first time where I've seen Intel not just playing catch up, but like, and this is the thing that their primary competitor at this point is AMD, and despite what Apple has unveiled, for Intel, they need to make sure that they can at least beat their closest competitor, AMD, and it depends on the actual benchmarks, but it looks like they've come out with a full slate of performance enthusiast products that can go toe to toe with what AMD has right now. This is a seismic shift for a lot of people, because for so long, Intel has been very content in doing very gradual, minor tweaks and updates. And with the failure of their previous attempts at,
We lost you for a second, there, Roger.
Intel has finally got it worked out.
You said failure at their previous attempts at competition.
At moving to a smaller process, a manufacturing process. That might be behind them if they can get these 10 nanometer chips out in scale, not just a small selection of them. That's really good. I think this could be the sign that Intel watchers have been waiting for. Like, what is Intel going to do? AMD's coming down. Apple switched over. A bunch of other companies are looking at producing in-house chips. This is a good sign. And they work really closely with Microsoft to ensure that Windows 11 runs as smoothly as possible on all these new chips.
Yeah, and in fact, Gelsinger was very positive about the yields on this. He was not talking about any restrictions, even with supply chain issues. You would expect him to talk about restrictions, but he's talking about shipping a couple million of these things. So it does seem like it would be unlike an Intel engineer to do a happy dance, but the closest thing to it in this announcement, right?
I mean, they set a goal, and I think they're meeting them, and that's huge for them.
Good luck to them.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger said Moore's Law is alive and well. Today, we are predicting that we will maintain or even go faster than Moore's Law for the next decade. If you don't know, Moore's Law is a famous observation that the number of transistors on a processor doubles every 2 years. People act like they know what Moore's Law is. They usually use it to mean a doubling of performance, which transistors and performance are pretty linked. Moore's Law was coined not by Roger Moore, the actor, but engineer and co-founder of Intel, Gordon Moore. Gelsinger, also an engineer, was literally talking about the number of transistors on a chip. And had a graph to go with his assertion. He doubled down, promising acceleration to Super Moore's Law. So slow down, Pat. Regain the market lead first. But pretty positive there.
Yeah, it seems kind of exciting. It might impact gaming. Let's talk about a couple of pieces of information that may happen in a data center full of Intel chips. I don't know. A couple of streaming pieces of news here. Google Stadia added support for free trials of individual games. First one gives you 30 minutes of Stadia's exclusive title called Hello Engineer. All you need is a Google account. All you need is a Google account. During the 30 minutes, you get the full game, though there is a little sidebar with a timer. I think that's actually kind of a weird idea. Hopefully, it's not too intrusive. Whatever progress you make is saved in case you want to buy the game. So they'll keep that in the cloud. Hello Engineer is $20 normally on Stadia or available in the Stadia Pro subscription service. They've done that so far with their internal games. Google says this is a test and that they will bring it to other games with other time lengths attached to those games. In fact, not everybody may even see the same game available for a free trial at any given time, which is a little weird, but we'll see what they plan with that. Meanwhile, and here's the, I think, the more interesting news in streaming games. Samsung announced it will launch a cloud game platform for its Tizen-based smart TVs. There were no details on any kind of launch date, what games would be available, any kind of partnerships there, or if it will launch on other platforms. But Samsung did seem to imply this would be a PC/console level sort of focus for games, not seeing this happen on mobile, which is interesting. I think there may still be room for a tie-in there in terms of remote gaming, but the focus seems to be consoles and possibly PCs. I don't know how you feel about this, Tom, but I feel like if there's one part of cloud gaming that hasn't been tapped very well, it's been a more international aim for a product like this. When we talk about xCloud and Stadia and Enforce or GeForce Now, all these different services, we're usually talking about the US markets and often European markets, but not necessarily places like India and China and all these other markets that have huge potential with old hardware that want to play new games and do it in this new cool way. And they often have better internet infrastructure in a lot of these places. So I think Samsung's got a chance to do something big here. And I don't think this is a small announcement.
No, it's a good point about the international market. And I think there's another aspect of this as well, which is, granted, Samsung's telling us nothing about this. I wouldn't be surprised if Samsung isn't using Stadia's white label service to do this, and they're just not ready to announce that part yet. But this strikes me as a logical follow-on to including apps on your smart TV. We have gotten to the point where you might have been skeptical about it, but people are using apps on their smart TVs. They really are. It's got a huge uptake. And some people prefer that. I don't understand them, but some people prefer that over a set-top box like a Roku, or even a smart stick. So I think this is clever to be like, yeah, and you know what else? We can get a lot of people doing PC and console level gaming if we just package a controller with the smart TV and say, look, you can play these games. You don't need to go buy anything special. You can just use your TV. You know, it's a service you'll pay for. We'll rake in a little money off of that, sure, but it comes with your TV and you don't have to add anything to it. That, I think, could become a big selling point for televisions.
Yeah, and the infrastructure of a television having all those apps available to it, like my LG does, tells me that the gateway is already there. It's just a matter of having the service up and running, because what are you doing? You're streaming content. And sure, this is a very different interactive kind of stream, but it's happening and it's real. And they got a lot of TVs and monitors in the world. I think they're in a really good position if they want to try something.
Yeah, I expect that there will still be people who want to add a box. They want to add an Xbox. They want to add a Roku. They want to add a Fire TV, whatever. But I do think this could potentially become another avenue into gaming for a lot of people who are like, yeah, it's fine. I'm just going to do the cloud gaming thing that came with my Samsung TV.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Casey Newton had some good points to consider on his platformer newsletter. If you're thinking about the Facebook papers released by Francis Haugen, we've covered those extensively this week. Newton talked to a former, that's important, not a current insider, but a former Facebook integrity team worker about the source of some of the posts being quoted in these articles. Now, former workers like Francis Haugen have been blowing the whistle on Facebook, but there's a different take coming from the worker that Casey Newton talked to. A lot of the cited posts in these articles you're seeing come from Facebook's workplace system. Workplace is something that Facebook markets to businesses as a work-appropriate version of the Facebook platform, kind of an intranet, a little bit like Slack, a little bit like Teams. It's sold for workplace communications, and it's used within Facebook. The worker told Newton that since the names and the job titles are redacted in these stories, rightly so, it is hard to tell which posts are credible and which are someone just spouting off, which does happen, certainly on things like Slack and Teams and one would guess on Facebook's own workplace. The worker said, this doesn't mean the posts shouldn't be reported. There just needs to be more context around them. Here's a few of that worker's points. These aren't leaked documents all the time. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're presentations or research. But a lot of times, they're just posts and comment threads. And the reports tend to treat all of those equally. And they're not. Anyone can post, anything at any time on Workplace, just like on Facebook proper. And not all posts are well thought out, and not all posters know the context of what they're posting about. Some do, but not all. So they're not all equally credible. If someone's saying something about Facebook in a post, that doesn't necessarily make it true. Just like when someone says something on Facebook, it doesn't necessarily make it true. Facebook Workplace needs some of its own fact-checking, I bet. Something positioned as an internal debate in a Washington Post story might have originated just as some off-the-cuff venting by an employee who was procrastinating getting back to work. We all do it, right? Newton has more in his newsletter if you want to get more of the details and more what that worker thinks. But suffice to say, it's worth remembering that context is important when reading these statements. Journalists could do a better job of pointing out this was a comment thread that this was said in versus this was a presentation made to executives. But it's also, as a reader, I think, important to take that into account.
Yeah, I agree. It's easy to say, I've been going through some of this on my own with some of my own stuff with chat rooms and things. It's easy to say, well, these are damning documents because they've come out, they've been leaked, and they're people saying things to each other. I can't believe they said these things. And my take would be, we can't have everything perfectly PR prepared to function as a people or as corporations or as just small businesses. Sometimes you just need to hash stuff out in an environment where you're restricted by maybe some common sense stuff. Like, you're not being rude to each other, you're saying terrible things, being sexist, whatever it may be. But being able to kind of speak your mind about a project, I think, is really important. And the idea that that's somehow, I don't know, controversial, that people have these internal discussions, I think is just blowing it way, way out of proportion. Now, if somebody says something crazy, you get Zuckerberg in there saying something that just really rocks the foundation of social media or ethics or something that they told Congress but they actually do, I mean, that's different. And you can do that paper trail or whatever. But most of the time, this is, like you said, this is like some Slack-like conversation. And sometimes those need to happen in their kind of raw, you know, organic form so you can get stuff done.
Yeah.
And I don't want us to be afraid of that.
When you're doing a post about the Facebook papers makes it sound like, this is a stack of official documents. I think reporters need to work extra hard to point out, now, this portion, this thing that was said, was a comment thread. And comment threads don't have the same weight as an official document, official presentation, a thing said in a meeting, etc. Comment threads are great for in the meeting someone said, right? And that could be useful, but they're not the same as here's an official pronouncement or here's what people think, right? Just a couple of posts are not representative of what people think. And again, this doesn't invalidate these stories that we've been hearing out of Facebook in any way, and that worker was not trying to say that. It's just to say there are certain parts of them that are a little more solid than other parts. And as a reader, beware of that when you're forming your own conclusions about what you believe about this.
Yep. Nuance matters, as always.
Folks, we talk about the stuff we think will help you understand technology better, but we also want to know what you want to hear us talk about on the show. And one of the best ways to let us know is our subreddit. You can get in there and submit stories and vote on them at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. You want more? I'm thinking you might be getting tired of the Facebook papers. Maybe you want more. Let us know. dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
As we mentioned yesterday, Adobe Max is underway. There's a web version of Photoshop and Illustrator. There's a rollout of Adobe's content credentials for taking images with authorship and edit records and even validating them as NFTs. Wednesday, Adobe did its more forward-looking announcements of technology, aka sneaks. These are things that might make it into Adobe projects someday. They also might not. We're going to run through a few of these with Scott and then get his overall impressions on Adobe Max. Let's start with Project Morpheus, which is for video what Adobe's neural filters are for images. Project Morpheus can tweak things in a video like how old someone looks or their hair color or their facial expression. Their demo showed taking someone who is not smiling and making them smile. It can also add facial hair or glasses. There's a limited number of tweaks and the subjects all have to be facing the camera. So this isn't a widespread full deep fake, but it could be used for good, like fixing a bad take in a movie, or it could make a prisoner look super happy and content, which would be a bad use. But, you know, generally speaking, what do you think of this, Scott?
I think it's just a natural extension of what Photoshop has always been, even without the AI machine learning. It's always been an opportunity to change a frown to a smile, to use just a simple example. But when my daughter was one and we were taking family pictures, she did not want to be there and cried the whole time. And when we were done, I took a shot of her smiling separately and I Photoshopped it on there. We printed giant form versions of this and gave it to my parents and they never knew the difference. And I would call that doing some good with this otherwise, you know, maybe sometimes unseemly use of the technology. I don't think this is a weird extension at all. In fact, I'm a little surprised that we haven't gotten to this stage sooner with Adobe specifically, because I think the future is, if they want to stay as relevant as they are, they got to just keep adding to this machine learning stuff. So I think it's cool. I mean, it's not full deepfake. It's closer to it. And I think people are going to find plenty of good uses for this. It's too easy to sort of attack it outright. So, you know, give that some time.
Strike a Pose is the next one, where you have a picture of, say, Scott with his hand pointing up in the air at a duck. And you have a picture of me looking straight ahead with my hands at my side. And you want to make a poster with my serious pose, but you need it to be Scott, not me. And you don't want to make Scott reshoot the photo. So you can use Strike a Pose to change the Scott photo into the same pose as the Tom photo. Adobe's Sense AI fills in all the details, like changes in how his clothing would drape, facial expressions and everything. They even did an example of it turning a model around to face the other way. So they had a model facing the camera, then they had a different model facing backwards, and they used this to turn the first model to face the other direction.
Yeah, the demo was actually pretty impressive. I'd argue that just like almost any of these features or features that have preceded any of this, in practice, it's often more difficult. And if you've got a noisy background, sometimes the AI is not going to perform well. And putting all that to the side, this is a great way for them to say, and I think this is maybe the whole Max conference is trying to do this, but this is a great way for them to say, hey, the CC subscription, which a lot of you might think is kind of expensive, and it kind of is. And you got to lock it in like you do an old cable subscription. It's a little bit unwieldy. Here's some new great reasons we think that this is worth your monthly money. And this is one of those. Project Morpheus is one of those. This is them separating themselves.
If they ever make it into Creative Cloud, we should point out, we should reemphasize that these are not in there yet. But yeah,
that's a good point, right? But I think they really, I mean, their bread and butter will be the future of that service, and it continually setting them apart from everybody else who may have a competing package of video editing, sound editing, photo editing, types of software, which I dabble a lot in. And these things are really compelling. Like you say, they're not in CC yet, but the idea is that these features would maybe start to show up. And I think that's a natural transition for them.
Last one I want to mention is Project In Between. This lets you take two or more photos and combine them to make an animation. They only said two or three. Maybe the max is three. This is kind of similar to what a phone does when you take a burst photo and then it picks a keyframe. And then later it'll say, like, you want to make an animated GIF out of it? And it takes a couple of those frames from the burst and makes an animation. It's that, except you don't have to do the burst. This could be like, man, I took three photos of my dog and none of them are great. Well, you could use this to make a little animation out of it using Adobe Sense AI. They don't have to be taken as the same batch, although it may get weird. You know, if you've got a flower on your dog, it's just going to morph. You choose the number of transition frames. That'll make it faster or slower. Adobe sees the main use of this is transforming these accidental photos on your phone and making a GIF out of them. So what do you think of that and Adobe Max in general?
Well, I think it's funny that we're still making GIFs and better ways to make them. I just think that's kind of hilarious for that format. But I would say this is basically tweening. This is high fidelity tweening is what they've described here with this in between. Essentially, they're saying object number one needs to get to object number two, fill in the blanks. And that's what we used to do in Flash and, you know, every other animation software. They call it tweening. I can't believe they've done it, but it looked to me like they've kind of done it. They've created like real photorealistic tweening. And that's crazy. In terms of my overall take on the conference, specifically from day one, going forward with a public facing sort of entirely web-based version of Photoshop and Illustrator, possibly more apps in the future, even though they're not fully featured, but featuring collaborative tools and that sort of thing, that's absolutely huge. That's gigantic because a lot of people who use their products count on that kind of collaboration. And right now it's sending a lot of PSDs back and forth with Behance or otherwise. This means, in theory, they can pull stuff up and across the country, somebody can make some small tweaks from where they are and all your stuff remains unscathed and you've got the file and you're good to go. I think that's a gigantic value add. And really, of all of these things, a lot of them are kind of pie in the sky, really interesting tech and everything. But that's the most like rubber meets the road decision I've seen them make in a long time. And I think that translates to actual like subscription upticks in a more meaningful way and faster. So overall, I think that's the entire point of Max, is to get people excited about signing up for CE or CC. Mm-hmm. But I think that day one stuff is maybe the most interesting in terms of what I can do right now and today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that makes sense, right? The R&D stuff you can't do, so you're going to be less excited about it. So,
yeah.
And it sounds like you got kind of excited.
I kind of did, and I've said it on the show before, but I've kind of moved to some other alternatives lately. I still have some of the Adobe stuff, but I'm paying a lot less for it, and I'm using other apps in their place. I have to admit, some of this stuff, and a web version of Photoshop, is very compelling for a lot of stuff I do. So it's doing its job of maybe bringing some who've veered away a little to try alternatives to maybe I shouldn't leave so soon. So I think that's a good thing for them. They got to keep innovating in that direction to keep me around.
All right, let's check our mailbag. Great discussion in our Discord yesterday relating to yesterday's show where Trisha Hershberger was showing off her new Pixel 6. Matthias said, how fair is it to review the Pixel 6 camera at the present and compare it to other phones? On one hand, it's completely fair because it's a product they're selling right now. On the other hand, so much of the Pixel camera magic was the AI, to the extent that Google didn't want to update the camera hardware for years because the AI was so well-tuned. Is there an argument, and Matthias is just asking the question, is there an argument that any camera comparison should have an asterisk and a required follow-up in 3 to 6 months?
I would say yes to the asterisk. The thing is, all cameras are software reliant, whether it's a standalone point and shoot or a DSLR or the one on your phone. Software is a big part of how the image comes out. And so I think, you should update it every time there's a new firmware update, there's some new software addition, but you do it at that point, because until that point, that camera is what you have. currently available on that phone, on that device. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, all products need to get regularly reevaluated as software becomes a pivotal part of how they function.
The bigger question is, like, when is it fair to say, yeah, we can now review that thing because we think it's as complete as it's going to be or as good as it's going to be, even though they updated it. And I would compare this, maybe unfairly, but compare it to like a brand new MMO style game. They're never great, as good at launch as they're going to be in a year or 2 years. And so you always see a lot of reviews in progress or a review so far, or someone will say a 2021 review of this 2011 game. See how it is nowadays. I think we're heading that way with a lot of these sorts of things. Like, why not look at that camera in 5 years and say, well, how did it end up? And you just kind of refresh your review, take a new take on it.
I think Matthias has got a great point about, especially about the asterisk, because reviews are meant for, you're making a purchase today on launch day. And granted, all of us wait, obviously, but most people buy things within the first few weeks of a product's release. That's when the majority of sales happen, or maybe not even the majority of sales, but that's when a lot of the purchase decision happens, right? People review how it is, and they may not buy it for 6 months, but it sets in their mind whether they're going to buy it or not. And that's why the reviews are, this is based on what it is today. But I think Matthias brings up a really good point. It's worth keeping in mind, hey, this product may change, might get worse, probably going to get better over time.
Yep.
Thanks for that email. Keep those coming. Feedback at dailytechnewsshow.com. Also, thanks to a brand new boss. Everyone, please welcome into the tent, Taryn Blake, who just started backing us on Patreon. Thank you, Taryn. Welcome. We're on a nice little streak here of having a brand new patron supporter every day. So we really appreciate that. We make a big deal, and everyone will say hi in the Discord and welcome you into the community. So if you're wanting that and you want to directly support the show, get the ad-free feed and all that stuff, patreon.com/DTNS. Thank you, Scott Johnson. Real quickly, before we get out of here, what do you got going on?
Well, as you know, it's Halloween week, and every year on a now old show that I do called Film Sack, been around since 2009, every year in October, we do what we call Sacktober, where we take all four of the weeks in October and do Halloween-themed films, old ones, new ones, everything in between. We are covering Freddy versus Jason this week. And so I'm just saying, if you've been sitting on the side going, man, I really meant to check out that awesome film show called Film Sack for all these years, maybe now's the time, because we had a really good time watching it. We'll have a great time recording it. That's filmsack.com for all the details. The podcast can be found anywhere. And if you're looking to tag me in real life and real time, find me on Twitter. I'm at twitter.com/ScottJohnson.
We are live Monday through Friday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. Back tomorrow with Justin Robert Young. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.